Hello and welcome to the Freelance Writers Free for All. I am Carol Tice from the Make a Living Writing blog, here with my guest co-host today, John Soares from Productive Writers.
Yeah, thank you, Carol. I'm very happy to be here. I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, me too. So what is the Free for All anyway? It's a chance to get your questions answered live by freelance writing pros. It's also a freewheeling, no baloney, nothing off limits, and no set length event. We answer some questions because we think it's fun, and then we stop when we think that we're about done. It's absolutely free to participate, and I like to give out free stuff. And today, John is going to be giving out free copies of his two books, his productivity book and his book on the niche that had my blog aflame yesterday on how to write textbook supplements. I have to say, I was really surprised how many people in my readership have advanced degrees, and this sounded like a really happening niche for them. I was totally blown away. But I kind of have a mission to spotlight lucrative niches that I think are less known. I'm kind of creating a collection of those. So I'm really glad to have John's contribution to that. So I started the Free for All because I get so many questions about freelance writing and I can't answer them all individually on email or on the blog anymore as mailbag posts. Plus, I discovered that I do not type very well while I eat lunch. So now on Wednesdays, I eat lunch while I answer questions on this broadcast. And today I'm actually so behind that I'm not really having lunch. I'm just having some cherries. And it's really sunny out, as I said. So I'm going to go out and probably eat my lunch after the broadcast. So a little disorganized. Hi from Portland. It sounds like it's sunny all up and down the coast, getting all kinds of things. Cheryl says she can't dial in. Hang on one second. If you have any technical problems, just try again. Hang on, Terry. We're not going to take live questions just yet. Actually, I'm going to shut chat down for now. And we're going to get to some of the questions that we got in registration about John's college textbook niche. As I said, we heard from a lot of people who were very interested in this niche. And I think to begin at the beginning, John, why don't you talk about how you sort of get the first gigs in this, both if you kind of have a teaching background and then maybe if you don't.
Well, what you need to do to get your first gig, there's several ways that you can get into contact with the editors at textbook publishing companies that hire freelance writers to create these supplements. And let me just quickly go back and say what the supplements are. The textbook supplements are things that help students to learn better or teachers to teach better. And examples would be an instructor's manual, PowerPoint lecture slides that the professors use in the classroom, student study guides that students can use on their own. Often these are online now. And then another big example would be writing test questions for students to take on tests during in class. And then also there's a lot of quizzes for students to do online when they're doing self-study. So the best ways to find these editors, I think the number one best way is to go through the sales representatives of the publishing companies. These are the people, I know some of you have taught college, some of you have not, but the sales reps come around to the various departments and the various instructors there and say, hey, adopt our book. That's how they make their money. But these sales reps are usually also in charge of finding people to write textbook supplements. So sales representatives are a good source, and you can usually find these by going to the textbook publishing company website, navigating through, and you can find the sales rep with an email address and a phone number. And then a second way to do it is you can find sometimes, depending, some companies it works and some it doesn't, you can find specific editors for your discipline of interest on the company website. You'll find a name and an email address. So that's the second way. The third way would be to ask other writers who are also doing this to help you out, to give you some contacts. That's another way to do it. Fourth, if you're already working in the field, you know some editors, ask them for contacts in other disciplines at their company. That has really helped me tremendously. And then final way to find the editors is to actually have the editors find you. And this has been happening for me a lot over the last year or two since I started having my own websites up and have been getting good with search engine optimization. They've been finding me and I've been getting jobs that way. And along that line, one last point is have a LinkedIn profile. Get on LinkedIn and fill that out so that when the editors, if they go looking for writers, they can find you on LinkedIn. And some do look on LinkedIn because I've been found.
I'm glad you bring that up because, yeah, everyone in every niche should be taking the time to stuff their LinkedIn profile with some good keywords for the types mm-hmm. of writing that they do. I've been getting found by very big companies. You think they must already know writers, but they don't. They're going on Google and searching on a freelance writer keyword, or they're going in LinkedIn and they're searching for writers. And if you've got your bio full of that, they will turn you up and find you. I wanted to ask about Terry's question in registration that she had taught high school. What about people who have taught sort of K-12? I mean, they've got textbooks too, right?
They absolutely do, and it would be a similar situation for contacting K-12. So what I'm talking about for the college textbook publishers also works for K-12. That's not my area of expertise. I haven't worked for K-12, but that is certainly a whole huge niche within itself. So most of the things that I will say here today and that were in my guest post yesterday on your blog, Carol, and in my ebook also apply to K-12. And if I could go back real quickly to the LinkedIn thing,
sure.
It just to build on what you were saying there, it is important if you are in a specific niche of writing to really get that keyword in there, and they do go look. And I think the more an editor is really involved with a certain small niche, the more they're going to go looking for quality people, and they'll look on LinkedIn, and they'll be on LinkedIn, and they'll know enough to go looking on there.
And so Pamela was asking, is this, you know, basically what's the reach out here? Is it a query letter? Is it a letter of introduction? You know, sort of what is the way, you know, especially if you haven't done it before, to sort of make your case that you could do this sort of very specialized work?
There's several things you need to do. On the most basic level, this works for any type of freelance writing, is you need to convince the editor that you can do a high-quality job and that you will deliver it on time. That's the key thing. So there's components of that. As far as doing the high-quality job, they want to know, do you have enough of a background in this discipline that you're going to be able to assimilate the amount of knowledge you need to get to, say, write good test questions or create good lecture outlines or things like that. So you have to convince them of that, and that's where your education background comes in. And so that's why initially you would start out in probably whatever your major was in college or something that is similar to that. I started out in political science because I have a master's degree in political science. And then I branched into history and then eventually on into earth sciences and life sciences and other social sciences because I also have academic background in that too. But to get back to specifically what you need to do to convince the editor, they're going to want to know that you can actually do this kind of work. So if you've taught before, you may have quizzes you've written, you may have your own lecture outlines you've used for your class, and you can use those as samples. And if you don't have specific samples, you can still get the assignments, but you're going to need to convince the editor that you can do it. And you may have to do something like say, hey, I will do a sample chapter for you to make sure that you are happy and comfortable with what I'm doing. And then you make sure you do a great sample chapter, and then you'll get the assignment.
Carol,
that's
again.
That's a risk reversal. Yeah.
Hi, sorry about that. I was thrown off the call there by lovely Skype. But I'm back.
Yes, well, that's okay, and I was just finishing up my answer.
Awesome, perfect. glad I didn't miss too much there. Unfortunately, the little recorder call didn't catch whatever the end of that was. But the any meeting one will have it. So that's cool. Hopefully we'll be able to use that. See, this is why we make multiple recordings.
Yes.
So, hang on. I want to retrace my thoughts here. I feel like I had a couple other textbook questions people had asked on in registration that I wanted to get to. It sounds like, you know, pretty much whatever academic area you studied, it's got textbooks and, you know, it needs this kind of work. Is that true?
Yes, it does. The vast majority of the supplements for textbooks are for courses that are taught at the lower division level. And that's because there's hundreds of students, there's a lot of textbooks that are sold at that level, large numbers, so they need lots of supplements, and they're more likely to have good money to pay supplements writers. So most subjects are there: physics, political science, biology, English. Just about anything you can think of is going to be pretty well represented and is going to have supplements created and you can work in it. And there was one question I'm seeing here that says, do you have to have an advanced degree for work like this, i.e. a master's? And the answer is no, you don't have to have a master's. And on a related subject, you don't have to have college teaching experience. They both really help, though. Because if you have an advanced degree, it shows you have a higher level of knowledge in the field. And if you taught college, it shows that you have experience in what's actually going to be happening with your supplements. However, I have seen it in many instances where people with bachelor's degrees in a subject and no college teaching experience have been able to get in and write supplements and get multiple projects a year and do quite well.
And so David had written in and asked if he can write them remotely. Is this mostly remote work, or do you have to physically go somewhere to do this thing?
It is 100% remote. I have been, I've done all of this living in places. I live in a rural area near Mount Shasta now. I did it for 3 years when I lived on Kauai in Hawaii in the 90s and all these places. I get to live wherever I want and do this work. So it's all remote. You just need to have an internet connection, and you need to be able to have UPS deliver packages to you. That's all you need.
Mm-hmm. So Doreen had written and basically said, you know, am I qualified to write this? You know, I have a degree. Hers is in journalism, and
mm-hmm.
I love to write. You know, is this one of these sort of you're qualified if you feel like, you know, I wrote a post a while back about how to tell if you're qualified for a freelance writing job, and the answer is, do you feel like you could do it? And
and that is a really good point.
If you do, then you can.
Do you feel like you could do it? And I can tell you, I took calculus in college, and I got A's in calculus, but I would not take a calculus project right now because I'm no longer qualified to do that. I know I don't have the level of knowledge to really do calculus anymore.
That'd be like me working with a German textbook, which was my language in college, but that is so all gone now. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's a question of, do you have the knowledge, or could you quickly get that knowledge back so that you were at the level where you could write good questions, or if it's something that's math-based, could you create new problems and be able to solve them and be able to do those sorts of things? So you either have to have that knowledge or know that you can very quickly get it back. So for example, if you were a sociology major in college and you went off and did other things, well, sociology is probably one of those subjects you can come back to it and you get the lower division intro to sociology textbook and you read it and you go, well, yeah, I remember all this. It all makes sense. And yes, I can write lecture outlines for this. And yes, I can write test questions, et cetera.
Maybe if you have a professor friend, you could get a set of, you know, this type of supplement stuff they're working with to just, you know, get a sense of what all is involved. And, you know, you'd probably go, oh, yeah, I could do this, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. If you know somebody, most of us know people who teach at the local college and you can go in and have a look at those. Yeah, that would be a very good idea.
So I want to get to some of the questions that are getting asked live about textbooks, and then we are going to switch over and talk about productivity, which we can all always learn and improve in. Lynn was saying if wanting to know if you needed an advanced degree, but I think we kind of covered that. Linda from California is saying, I tutored people in various fields outside my major. Does that, you know, sort of count for some educational background?
Yes, Linda, that would help you a lot. The key thing is just convincing the editor, can you do, yes, I can do this. And then when you get the assignment, making sure you do a really good job. And then you can be in and you'll keep getting repeat assignments.
And
so you would need to point that out and say, yes, I tutored in this field and that field and that field. I think that would help you a lot.
And so is it the kind of thing where it's going to go through multiple edits? You know, what's sort of the editorial process?
The editorial process varies. What I do whenever I send off any work I do is I never assume that somebody else is going to edit my work and fix any errors I made. I always assume that what I send is what they're going to use. And so I always proofread everything. My test questions especially, you have to go through and make sure that they are clear and easy to understand and that for sure you've marked the correct answer and there's only one correct answer, all those things. You can't assume somebody's going to proof. And in many instances, they really don't proof. Or just the editor that you're working with will quickly buzz through it, maybe run a spell check or something.
Huh, so they're really expecting you to kind of be self-editing and turn in something that's really, really clean.
Yes and no. I know a lot of them do edit what I send in, but I've also had times where they didn't edit it. And you also can't assume that whoever is editing you is an expert in the subject matter. So if you have something that's factually wrong, they may not catch that. If you have the wrong date or if you mark the wrong answer, for example, they may not catch that. They just may be looking for spelling and grammar and punctuation.
Eek.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're really relying on you to deliver
the
knowledge.
Yes. And that's I've had that happen often. Many of the projects are you are updating a previous supplement from the previous edition. Textbooks have new editions every 2 to 3 years. And so whenever there's a new edition, the supplements all have to be updated. So frequently you will get an assignment saying, hey, we have this set of test questions for the old edition of the textbook. We need you to go through and take out questions that no longer apply and then write some new questions. But then there's all these questions that still apply from the, say, the third edition to the new fourth edition. And I find that I go through and I start reading some of these old questions and they're either hard to understand. Some of them are hard to understand. Sometimes the answer is wrong or it's just not the level that I think it's going to be. So I wind up having to do more work than I thought I was going to because I'm having to edit and fix the old edition.
So this kind of keys into the question Felicity was asking about what the process is and sort of what you get from the publishers. So it sounds like sometimes you get a set of existing materials that you're updating, but what if it's a new textbook and there isn't sort of previous materials to as a sort of starting point? How do you develop what you're doing?
Typically what will happen is you will work from page proofs that are at the level of PDF files, and usually they're either first pass or second pass page proofs. And this happens usually if you're updating from a new edition or not to a newer edition from an older edition, or if it's a brand new first edition textbook, is you will have PDF files that you can either print out or you can look at them on your computer screen, however you want to do that. But usually it's at the stage where it already looks like a textbook, like they could print it out in color and bind it and you'd have a textbook, all the art is in place, the tables are in place and all that. So you're working from that. And you want to try very hard to work from page proofs rather than author manuscript, which is a much messier thing and can change over time. So you're typically working with that, and if you are updating something, let's say the test questions, you would get the copies of the old test questions, both in printout form, and then also, more importantly, you would get usually the Word files that you would be updating, and then you would have that to carry on with.
So, John, Wade's asking how many publishers are out there. Is this the kind of thing where it's sort of controlled by three big places, or are there dozens and dozens?
There are essentially seven large companies and then another 30 or 40 smaller companies. And the seven large ones grew pretty much by accretion. They just kept buying out smaller companies. So some of them are very, very large. And those are the ones you want to target because, for example, for me with political science, a company like Cengage, which is a very large company, has the Wadsworth imprint. They may have a dozen different American government textbooks that I could work on, and actually that I have worked on in the past. I've done a lot of work for them, for their political science texts. So those are good ones to get into, if you're a political science person, because you have far more opportunities to work. So once you get in with one editor, that editor may have 30 or 40 assignments a year, for example, to give out, or even more.
Right on.
Yeah.
Yeah, right on. So talk about how the fee thing works on here. I have a couple questions from Linda and Lisa on that. You know, do they say, here's the thing and it pays $1,500 or, you know, or is there some kind of negotiation or do they ask you to quote them a price or how does it work?
It can go any of those ways. Typically what they say is they'll say, we have this project, this is what we need done, and this is what we can pay you. That's what it is about 97% of the time. And what I do is I look at that fee, I look at the work, and then I figure out roughly how many hours it's going to take me to do all that work, and then I look at the total amount they're paying me, I do the division, and I come out with an hourly rate. And sometimes if the hourly rate is quite high, which for me would say was like, gosh, I think I'm going to make $70 an hour doing this, I may not ask for more money. But I would say two-thirds of the time, I do ask for more money.
And right I'll
say, on. Yeah, I'll say, I'll go through and I'll say, oh, this is a very interesting project. I really like this subject, and the textbook I know is a very good textbook. There's a lot of work that needs to be done here, and I'll go through and I'll do bullet points as it needs this and this and this. This is going to take a lot of time, so I would like X amount for the project. And a good percentage of the time, they can pay more, and sometimes they just can't. Sometimes they just have a fixed budget, and they say, this is all we can pay. Sorry. Mm-hmm. And then you have to decide what you're going to do on that.
But there's never a harm in this niche or any other, in my view, of saying that to me. To me, negotiation is like a massive weak spot in the writer community. Most writers, someone tells them, this is what we're going to pay, and they go, okay. And they never look at it and cost it out like you just did, say, what's this really going to work out to on an hourly rate? Is that really worthwhile? I actually just had someone throw a bid at me, that huge lump of work, to write, you know, 23,000-word profiles of companies, and they wanted to pay $700 a profile. And I was like,
whoa.
Yeah, I was like, that's funny. The number in my head was at least twice as large as that. So what do you say about this? So, yeah, I'm probably not going to do it because that's going to be like white slavery there. 3,000 words is a lot of words to put together into a profile.
Yeah, absolutely.
But people don't realize that there's no crime in asking, you know, in saying, well, this is how I size up this job and I think the value of it is X. And the worst thing that happens is they say, nope, this is all we got, right?
Absolutely. That's the worst they can say. I find I do a lot of repeat work with my clients, and the projects vary. And sometimes they come to me with a project that I think, wow, this is paying great. And then sometimes it's lower. But I don't want to be like, for me personally, when I'm trying to keep a really good relationship, I don't want the editor to always feel every time I come to John with a number, he always asks for 40% more. And
yeah.
Yeah,
and there is a limit to how much more you can really ask people for and expect
right.
to get
it. It's a delicate balance, and but I'm a strong advocate of asking for more money, and I've seen it happen time and time again with people I know that they're just starting out, and they get their first offer, and they'll get an offer from a company and say, oh, well, we'll give you $2,000 to write the instructor's manual and create the test bank, and they go, yes, great. And then they look at the amount of work they have to do, and they make maybe $10 an hour on it, and really it should have been $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 or something that they should have gotten or more for that. So
yeah, I think there's an excitement when you get a big project, especially if you aren't used to working on big projects. You haven't done like white papers or large volume projects where that, you know, $2,000, that sounds like a ton of money. But yeah, if it ends up to an hourly rate that's really low, you're still in trouble.
Exactly. And if you're just starting out in any field in freelance writing, your first two or three assignments, if you're looking to get some publication credits and to just build your authority, you might need to take a little bit lower pay just to get in the door, and then you can use that to leverage out your career and wind up making a lot of money down the road. But
yeah, but
in general, it's best to just see what they can pay, because oftentimes they actually could pay you $8,000 for the project, but they offer you $5,000 and then you take it. Or they have a certain amount of money they can spend for the whole year for supplements, and if they offer you $5,000, but if you say, no, I want $8,000, they may say okay, and then they just take $3,000 from someplace else and give it to you.
Yeah. I just think that so much money gets left on the table by freelance writers who don't consider that opening offer as the opening of a negotiation rather than, you know, here is what it is, the end.
Yeah.
They just sort of tend to take it and say, okay. Now, what you're saying about starting out, though, is really, really true. You know, what I say about starting out in any area of freelance writing is you really shouldn't even be that focused on the pay. You should be focused on, are you getting to work on great projects that give you great clips for great people who could refer you to great paying gigs in the future? You know, that's more the focus. You know, I had someone say they had an offer to write some articles and they were only $25, but it was someone with no clips and they really needed some fresh clips. And I was like, you know, in your situation, you might do two or three of these just to get the clips. Don't do 50 of them. But, you know, sometimes, yeah, you just do a few initial projects and you're not that focused on, oh, what's my hourly rate? You're just getting your portfolio together so that you can get a good rate down the road.
Yeah.
Anyway, I want to switch over and talk about productivity, because I feel like, you know, we could all always be more productive. I know I could have been more productive today. I should have like written an article this morning that ain't written yet. So Catherine had asked in registration if you have techniques for balancing breaks and vacations to maximize productivity. And I, as many people who are regular readers of my blog may know, I'm on a vacation for 25 hours every single week, all in a row, from Friday night to Saturday night. And I don't know how people function without a whole day where they are completely off the computer. But I call that the secret of my success. What do you have to say on that, John?
Well, I think it's really important to have quality time off away from work, and ideally away from the computer. And if you can do it, get away from the cell phone or anything that's going to be giving you those sort of constant or whatever intermittent pay attention to me, pay attention to me, pay attention to the whole big wider world, internet, work, all those sorts of things. So I think it's really important for people to balance those things. And I find in my own life that I take time every day for myself. I have a Tai Chi practice. I do Tai Chi every day. I do a little yoga every day, and I'm a hiker and a walker. So just about every day I do at least, say, a 20-minute walk, and sometimes I'll do several hours. Then there's also times when I have a lot of work. My work sometimes tends to clump up, and then I deal with it the best I can. But I make sure I focus on my highest priorities, which would be getting my work done, and then also taking care of my health, and then obligations and things you have with family and loved ones. But it is definitely important to get that time off.
And, you know, I think you brought up the other thing that's sort of the missing link for so many freelance writers, which is taking time to stay physically fit and keep your conditioning up. You know, if you go to a conference of freelance writers, it is scary. Everyone is very, you know, spherical and out of shape. And that's bad for the whole world of writing, because that means that you're all going to be living shorter lives and contributing less for less time. And it really, really, it's so vital. And a lot of times people write to me and be like, what do I do about writer's block? I'm like, I don't know. I go walk uphill for an hour and then I'm ready to write my story. You know, I think people really discount the value. They think they don't have time to do it, but they really don't have time not to do it.
I agree so totally. Your health the health of your body affects the health of your brain and your emotions, your stress level, everything. And that really affects your ability to get your writing done. And for me, everybody has their own priorities, but my main priority is to live a long, healthy, and happy life. It's not to make a lot of money or to, oh, I've got 5 million words in print somewhere. That's my main goal. So I agree with you. I see a lot of people that don't take care of their health, and it does get you in the long run. And there's been studies that have come out primarily over the last few months, but there's actually a correlation with spending a lot of time sitting down and early death.
I know. Didn't that stress you out? It's like sitting tells your body to die. It was really scary stuff.
And I think they're still working out, is it correlation or is there actual causation? But there may be some causation, although they're still trying to figure out all the factors with that. But it's just something to think about. Or think about, yes, you need to spend time sitting down and writing. And yes, you may need to do things online, like take care of your email. And I'm a blogger. Carol, you're a blogger. Several of these other people are likely also bloggers. So you may be doing the whole social media, you know, that sort of stuff. But really think about what do you really need to do and when do you really need to be on the Internet. And be smart about it. Like, I try to just check my email 3 or 4 times a day, unless I know there's something, like, really important going on, so I don't get that distraction of my brain always being in several different places at once and always looking for something kind of new, interesting, different.
Distracting.
Yes.
Not on your own agenda. I have to tell you, I'm the worst with email. I want to do that. I want to only pick it up 3 times a day, and I just... it's so hard to resist. I don't know. Email is my worst distraction.
Well,
I'm able to corral all the other goofing off, like playing Bejeweled or whatever, to, you know, at night when I'm done. But the email, it's just, and often I'm really vindicated because there'll be like job offers sitting on there and stuff. And then you just think, crap, I just can't ever be off of this, you know. But I know that it's really toxic. It's really the hugest distraction, because really when you're checking email all the time, what we're really saying is I don't really want to do what I'm supposed to be doing. I know
exactly.
That I'm supposed to be setting up interviews or writing this article or, you know, building courseware for Freelance Writers Den, which is what I'm supposed to be doing now big time, or testing all of my buy buttons on Freelance Writers Den to make sure they're working and that I can give refunds, you know. But instead, I'm looking on email and then I'm reading, part of the distraction problem for me is I love to learn and I still consider myself a really big student of social media and best practices in, you know, web conversion and stuff. So I have all these materials I could be reading, and, you know, if I see one of those that's coming on email, I'm like, oh, I could just stop for a minute, take a look at this. And yeah, and the next thing you know, it's like 2 hours later.
Yeah, and it's a tough one because it's so easy to get distracted in so many ways on the Internet. But I hear you with the email, because there's times where there are things that are timely that show up on email, and it's good to get it, say, now rather than 6 hours from now. But what I do is I will say I'm going to do this certain chunk of work. Once I am done with this chunk of work, maybe it's a 40-minute chunk or a 60-minute chunk, or something like that, then I'll say, I will finish that. Once that is finished, I will go check my email. And then it keeps me from thinking, oh, I'm kind of in, this is getting a little hard right now, and I want a little distraction. Oh, let's go see if I have an email. Oh, so-and-so sent me an email. Let me read it, see if it's important, that sort of stuff. And that can waste a lot of your time.
I'm just cracking up because that's just so me. So Terry was asking... if you use voice recognition at all to do anything on the computer. I know I don't.
I don't, but I am starting to get interested in that. I have a digital voice recorder that is always in my pocket. It's a very small one, but it's a very powerful one, and I'm always putting in all the everything from ideas for blog posts to ideas for new ebooks and information products to my general to-do list. These are the things I have to do, and I don't have a perfect memory anymore, if I ever did, and so I'm really big on having lists and my yearly, weekly, monthly planner, daily planner stuff. So I have thought about, wow, could I start dictating blog posts into my digital recorder and then transferring it over. There's Dragon Naturally, which is Naturally Speaking or something, which is a software that can do that. And I've heard that the more expensive, more advanced versions of the software can take MP3 files and take your words and turn them into your spoken words and turn them into written words. So I'm considering that. I just haven't quite gotten there yet. So my
voice recognition has come a long way. There's actually a video floating around YouTube of John Morrow from Copyblogger using Dragon because he cannot move any limbs at all. He has an advanced form of muscular dystrophy. And it's amazing. I remember when that sort of technology first came out and it was just useless. And it really does work now. I don't know whether for me, it probably wouldn't be faster because I type like 120. So
yeah.
I'm a really fast typist, so I don't see how it would really make me faster. To me, the one thing that keeps me on track, and it's sort of a habit from my staff writing days, is that I try and write a to-do list before I leave the office. Because I think there's a lot of time wastage in the morning where you come in and it's like, what the heck was I supposed to do today again? And you start poking around your stuff. To me, it's like you're in it at the end of your day. You're going, oh, yeah, tomorrow I got to write this article. I need to start this article's research and set up some interviews. I need to finish this blog post. And, to me, if I just jot down whatever those, absolutely critical have to get done tomorrow items are, that can really drive me the next morning. I come in, there they are. I'm like, oh, yeah, that thing. And then I just dive right into it.
I think that's a smart way to go. I have a similar system. I have one of those 8.5 by 11 yearly planners where each week is over 2 pages. And what I do is I put things out throughout the week that I need to do. And then what I'll do, like tonight, maybe late this afternoon, early evening, when I finish, I will say, all right, what do I need to do tomorrow? And then I go to my to-do list for Thursday, and then I write down the things I need to do, and I will number them 1, 2, 3 as far as the priority order of which they and when they need to happen. And I also have a special section where I put communications, who do I need to send emails to, and all that sort of stuff. But it is really good to put everything down that you need to do the next day and have it on your to-do list, because like you're saying, Carol, you come in and it's like, oh, yeah, this is exactly what I need to do. I'm not going to sort of fool around and just kind of get online and start checking email and blog posts and Twitter and stuff. You can get right to work. And
or
then
just
also,
poking around trying to remember what it was that was
yeah,
the top priority.
Exactly. And it also allows your brain to rest. It may even let you sleep better because your brain isn't having to think, oh, what do I need to do tomorrow? I have to remember that I have to do this or that. You've written it down and your brain can just relax.
John, you just hit why I do it, because I am totally that person. Otherwise, I'm laying there in bed and the wheels are going, oh, my God, okay, first thing tomorrow, I got to remember to call this person before they go to lunch. And, yeah, and it won't shut off. So it
yeah.
does really help me just go, yeah, I'm done now until tomorrow.
And that's
anyway,
another good point about productivity and happiness and health, and that is to get off the computer a good 2 or 3 hours before you go to bed. If you at all can, try to arrange your life so that you can just shut it off, be done with it, and walk away from it, and you're not having to think about work or anything related to that. You can be doing things for your health and eating, going for walks, spending time with your family, those sorts of things. I think that's really important. And also to make sure that if you watch television at night, which I do very rarely, I watch very little television, but be careful what you watch right before you go to bed and also what you read, because if you're reading or watching things that have to do with, let's say, really violent activities, if you're watching some crime show on TV or something, it can actually affect how you sleep because your brain may be processing those images and they may wind up shaping your dreams and dreams such that you're not as restful in those dreams because they may have violence or things that you would prefer to not have in there.
Yeah, I think the thing about the internet is it's just so always on and always there. And it's not when you have a freelance business, it's not like when you have a day job where people are expecting you to show up at 9 and then at 5 they expect you to go home and you can feel like, okay, well, I feel done now. It's like it's a bottomless pit where you could always be doing more to market your business and stuff. And so you have to set those boundaries yourself and say, here's where done is for today. And there's always more I could do, but you know, the Jewish joke is, you know, God didn't call you a human doing, you're called a human being.
Yeah.
Because some of the time you're supposed to be just enjoying this beautiful world that we live in and not worrying about filing and deadlines and finding clients. And, you know, it's not all about that. Yeah, you have family. And anyway, let's give out some free stuff.
Okay, that sounds good. We have one copy of each of my two ebooks to give away. And let's see here. How about for writing college textbook supplements? Let's go with, let's give out a free copy of that to Linda from Fair Oaks, California.
Cool. Okay. And then you have your productivity one.
Yes, and then we have intelligent productivity for freelance writers. And who would be a good option for that? Let's do...
I see Lynn here asking a productivity question down on the bottom.
So you think that we should go with Lynn?
Yeah.
All right. Lynn, you're the winner. So we got Linda and Lynn.
Coolness. And if you don't have them on the spreadsheet, you probably do. But if you don't, let me know. And
okay.
John will be in touch with you guys to ship you your books. That is nearly it for this edition of the Freelance Writers Free for All. Thanks to John Soros for joining us, offering some really interesting background on the textbook supplement niche, and I think great stuff on productivity and life balance there. Before we go, I do want to mention that subscribers to the Make a Living Writing blog receive the free report, 40 Ways to Market Your Writing. Subscribe now, because besides that free thing, I'm always sending stuff to my subscribers that I never post on the blog, so you want to be on the inside track of that. People who participate live in the calls are really cool, and just want you to know that coming up, as the Freelance Writers Den gets open, I'm going to be giving away more goodies, like free one-week trials and stuff, to people who show up live on the calls. I am Carol Tice from the Make a Living Writing blog. This has been the Freelance Writers Free for All. Keep those questions coming, and we will see you next week when our guest is going to be a Seattle writer friend of mine, Candace Dempsey. And she is going to talk about how her personal blog that she started got her a nonfiction book deal to write about the Amanda Knox murder in Italy. So really, really interesting story of how she positioned herself with her blog to get to write a really hot, popular book. So I can't wait for that. Thanks a lot, everybody. Thanks, John.
Yeah, thank you, Carol. It was great being here.